Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me here, and thank you very much for coming to the talk. So I just got a warning or a remark that this title is not the same as the one I submitted. That's right. I just realized kind of if I take this title, it consumes half of my title page. So I stick to that one, but it will be the stuff that is in the abstract. So essentially what I will be talking about is there. It's kind of non-equilibrium phase transitions with spin dark states. And maybe the word that is might not be familiar to everybody is kind of what is a dark state. So what I will be dealing with in this talk is dynamics, steady states of driven dissipative quantum systems. So in these systems, you have some Hamiltonian time evolution of some spin system. You have this spin system coupled to some bath. So you have some leakage of energy into the bath. So this gives you dissipation. And you have some external drive. In this context, you're not talking about kind of pure states or eigenstates typically, but you have to go to a density matrix formulation. And if this density matrix is a pure state, to which, I mean, the density matrix to which the system evolves and which stays stable is a pure state, then you call this thing a dark state. If it's kind of a statistical mixture, then you know this is a mixed state. And essentially, the type of criticality I would like to talk about is we have a system, we drive it, it has dissipation, it has some Hamiltonian, and then it evolves towards, let's say, some dark state where, just imagine, all the spins in the system are pointing down. So I have this cartoon image here where I say I start from the right, essentially the dark state or the state in which the system is all the spins, so all these dots here are spins, they're all pointing down. These are the blue ones. And then I just insert one red one, one spin up. And then this spin up, because it somehow is on a very particular dark state, starts an avalanche of spin ups which spreads throughout the whole system. So that you see here. So it spreads throughout the whole system. Then it kind of this spraying decays, and the system goes back into a state where all the spins are pointing down. And this is a cartoon image, essentially, and this is the corresponding kind of simulation where you here have time on the y-axis and you have space on the x-axis, so it's a one-dimensional system. And essentially, what you see here is all these kind of avalanches that are kicking off because one spin is excited, and then it starts an avalanche, and then all the things are going down again. So this is what I would like to talk about and kind of find a notion of criticality in this system. Okay. So the first part of the talk is kind of setting the stage a bit for the second part, where I will be talking about first order dark state phase transitions. So what do I mean by this? I have a system which is essentially driven. It has some dissipation. And now let's say I change the driving strength. And as a function of the driving strength, the system undergoes a phase transition. On one side of the phase transition, the system wants to evolve into a dark state. So the steady state is a pure state, shown here. So it has zero for Neumann entropy because it's just one state, one pure state. And on the other hand, it's in a mixed state. Could actually be a possibility to get some water.
I'll bring some.
Thank you. I just realized my mouth is getting really dry. And on the other hand of the phase transition, kind of the system wants to evolve into a mixed state. So it's a statistical mixture. It has a finite von Neumann entropy. And what we realize or what we find is that in the middle, I mean, at this phase transition, the system jumps. So it's a first order phase transition. The system jumps from a pure state to a mixed state. And the entropy of the system jumps from zero to some finite value. And this means on the right side of this phase transition here, where you have, here on this side where you are in a mixed state, you have strong fluctuations, you have like a macroscopic phase space that the system can explore, while on the right side, it's just kind of evolving towards one state and it's just staying there, so the phase space is very small. Thank you very much.
Any particular reason first order versus second order?
No. Also, possible second order, but the system I will be talking about at first order. Okay, now then, if we go kind of, if we move away from this model and say, let's look into some realistic experimental setup, which we actually did together with some experimentalists in Heidelberg, now in Strasbourg, Shen Whitlock's group. What we find is that this description that we were applying in order to study kind of this phase transition was not kind of, it was an idealized system. The true system has some caveats. it's more complicated, but actually what it turns out, this kind of additional complication makes the dynamics much more interesting. Because what happens is that now, when the system is in this mixed state phase, it experiences some additional dissipation, which pushes the system towards the phase transition. And this dissipation is not present on this side of the phase transition. So essentially, if you start here, you're just stuck here. If you start here, the system moves towards the critical point and kind of wants to stay there, essentially. And what you find in this situation is that no matter how you initialize the system, as long as it's on this side, you're evolving towards a critical point expressed in, again, like what I'm plotting here are spin excitations in time and space, and you see kind of this nice fractal avalanche structure here. So the system kind of wants to evolve towards a critical state, and in this state, kind of, it has a very nice kind of dynamics that I would like to explain during the talk. Okay. Let's start with the microscopic model that we're having in mind. So essentially, I'm talking about spins all the time, but the underlying model is a model of atoms. So what we're having atoms. These atoms have many kind of different internal states, but we're just talking about two states of the atoms. So we can model this as a pseudo spin. So we say the atom can be in a ground state. We say the ground state is like a spin down, and it can be in a particular excited state, and this excited state is spin up. So for some people that are familiar with cold atoms or with kind of atoms in general, this is really the ground state, and this is something like a Rydberg state. So it's a highly excited atomic state. And these are the two kind of states which I will be talking about. Okay, now we're taking a single atom, which we model as this two-level system, as a spin up or spin down. Then we coherently drive this. So we want to drive this transition with a laser, or in case of a spin, think about of an oscillating magnetic field. This has a driving strength omega, and the frequency that is detuned from the transition here, which is delta. So delta means it's the difference in the frequency compared to this excitation energy here. And because the system couples to some environment, in the case of atoms, it's just kind of the photon vacuum background, you have some incoherent loss in terms of spontaneous emission. So if you have a spin up, it can decay spontaneously into a spin down state, but if you have a spin down state, it will only be excited by this driving. Now, if this difference here is very large, so if you drive the system off resonant, then kind of the excitation rate, so the probability with which you make excitations from the ground to the excited state is very small. So essentially, you can say this, you can tune this to zero, essentially, on all the scales of the system. Okay. But what you can do, you can take many atoms, and now these guys, they can interact, but they interact in a very specific way. And this is the van der Waals interaction, because what I mentioned is you have an atom that is either in the ground state or in the excited state, and in the excited state, what you're doing, you're taking the outer electron and shift it to some high-lying orbital, and then this atom is easily polarizable. So what happens if you bring two atoms that are excited, or two spin-ups in this language together, then they will repel each other via the van der Waals force. If you just have one atom in the ground state and one in the excited state, or one atom, or both atoms in the ground state, they will not interact. So they don't see each other. So what you can do now is you can detune your kind of driving field from this transition such that it matches the transition energy plus the excitation energy. What happens in this case, you're driving the system off resonant if all the atoms are in the ground state or all the spins are pointing down, but you're driving the system resonant as soon as one spin is pointing up, because via the indirection energy, you now have kind of a resonant transition. And this kind of you can formulate in terms of a kinetically constrained model. So imagine what we're doing. We're having now a gas of free moving spins. All the spins here are pointing down, one guy is pointing up. So this guy generates some interaction with the other guys, potential interaction, if they're pointing up. So it creates a circle in which this van der Waals interaction is strong enough to compensate both kind of the detuning, or to compensate the detuning, essentially. So what happens, these two guys are pointing down and are lying, the green ones, and are lying in this radius, and now they can get excited, because their kind of excitation energy and frequency matches. So they can get excited. They start already with something like a small avalanche. And then you see now these two guys, of course, I draw it in a way that it matches, but now these two guys can get excited. And if you have a gas of free moving atoms, so what you can imagine is that you just have all these guys in the ground state or spin down, nothing happens. Then you start exciting one guy. And then what happens is there's an avalanche spreading through the system. One guy is exciting the other guy and so on. So this is like a minimal model where you have a spreading versus decay of excitations. And the decay is still the original one, where when you have an excited atom, it can just spontaneously decay into.
So how does that differ from superluminescence?
From what?
Superluminescence.
I don't know exactly.
Super radiance. Right.
In super radiance, you have like a non-local interaction typically. So when you think in terms of a cavity, what you're having is that all atoms interact with all other atoms, but this is local because this interaction is like decaying with 1/6 power. So you just have some kind of local thing. While in super radiance, you typically have like one state, like all the atoms down or all the atoms in the paramagnet and all the other one and all the atoms aligned. And there's no notion of kind of how the transition from one state to the other happens locally. So it's just kind of everything can happen, essentially. Here it happens locally. Okay. So now I would like to study when I have this kind of kinetically constrained model, which is the stationary state of this system. So for this, I'm deriving kind of an effective field theory. You can think of this as some sort of an easing theory. What I'm taking is I'm looking at the density of spin-ups in my system. So I say I take a certain volume. Typically, it's a volume in which 10 atoms are confined. And then I ask, what is the number of upspins in this volume? And this gives me a number. If all the spins are pointing down, then this number is 0. If some of the spins are pointing up, this number is larger than 0. So this is my order parameter in this system. Now, if I look at the dynamics of this order parameter, what I get is effectively this Langevin equation here, where I have the time derivative of this field is given by some diffusion, some potential, and some noise. This potential has this form. So from this part of the equation, there's nothing new here. You could think of this just as an equilibrium field theory. The interesting part is here, this multiplicative noise. So if you look at this noise kernel, you see that this noise kernel is proportional to the density. And this is different. If you were in thermal equilibrium, this would be the temperature. And the reason why this is different is, if you look at these spin clusters, the number of excitations that you're generating in one cluster is proportional to the number of excitations that is already there. Because if you have no excitations, you will not generate more excitations. But if you have some excitations, then you will generate more. This is very similar to kind of population models, where you're saying, let's look at a city. You have a certain number of people living in that city, and the fluctuations of people are proportional to the number of people, because they give birth to people, and they die. And this can only be proportional to the number of people that are already there. So from this perspective, what you see here is a spin model that behaves in some sort like population models. Now looking at this potential here, so the potential here has this form. It has a bistability. So it has these two solutions where the field is 0 and where the field has a finite value. So the deterministic dynamics would like to sit either here or here. So in equilibrium, you would say the system just chooses the minimum of the potential, right? Because the noise level is uniform. So what happens, you can have transitions from this to this state and from this to this state with kind of probability that is just given by the energy difference here. So you would have some Arrhenius law. But out of equilibrium, when you have this kind of noise, that's not true anymore, because you immediately see once your system is here in this state, it will never leave this state. Although it's kind of maybe not the energetically favorable state, because there's no noise or no activation mechanism that would kick the system out of this state. So if you once initialize the system here, 0 density, or here, 0 density, then you will stay there, even though kind of the potential would like to push the system into another state. Okay. In terms of this order parameter field, this is our dark state. When the field is 0, then also the fluctuations are 0, and this we associate with being in a pure state. No statistical fluctuations means we are in a pure state. Here, we are not in a pure state. We have finite density. That means we have statistical fluctuations. That means we are in a mixed state, essentially. And now we want to study the dynamics of this. So on the mean field level.
So the dissipation, right? The spontaneous emission.
Sorry?
The dissipation.
Yes, the dissipation is spontaneous.
So
emission.
This model assumes that no photon that is emitted by spontaneous emission gets reabsorbed, right?
Yes. So in principle, we think that the continuum, that the kind of environment is in a zero temperature state and is infinitely large. So there is, now if you're asking about this, so in principle, we only consider anti-Stokes terms, kind of. So if you consider Stokes terms too, then they would be typically very small. So it's a question of separation of timescales, because we also have kind of off-resonant excitations, which we never can get rid of. But the question is kind of, we have some typical system timescales, which are encoded here. And then we have all these timescales that we don't want, like the ones you mentioned. And if they are kind of much, much smaller, then the kind of scaling or the kind of dynamics that we would like to see is described by this idealized version of the field theory. It's very much like, I mean, the whole thing is very much like when you study quantum phase transitions, you never are at zero temperature. But if your kind of measurements that you're doing can resolve, are in the scaling regime and can resolve kind of energy scales above the temperature, then you see quantum scaling. Although kind of the long wavelength limit would always be kind of a classical scaling behavior. Okay. So let's go to the mean field picture of this bistability. So what we're having is we have this potential here. And if we forget about kind of spatial fluctuations, so we are in a mean field picture, the only thing that we take into account is this potential form and the noise, then what kind of dynamics would we expect? So we would expect we initialize the field somewhere here, and then it just rolls down to the basin of attraction of the of this region in which you initialize it. So in principle, you have a separatrix here. When you initialize the system somewhere here, it will just deterministically roll down or evolve towards this minimum. If you evolve it here, then it will evolve to this minimum. Now you can have noise activation here, which tells you, OK, deterministically, it will go down here. But if it has noise, there's a certain probability that the whole system gets activated and overcomes this barrier and rolls down here. The funny thing now, as I kind of already emphasized, is that you say, if you are here, your system can have noise activation. You can overcome this barrier and fall down here towards this state. But if you once arrive at this state, there's no noise. So we'll stick there. So in a mean field limit, the only solution that you get for this is that the system is in the dark state. Because there is a possibility, no matter how long you wait, that the system just gets kicked over this barrier and ends up here. So without spatial fluctuations, the solution is you are always in a dark state. Now, if you include spatial fluctuations, the question is, do you see a first order phase transition in this system or not? Because again, you have this problem. Once you end up here, you will always stick there. You will never kind of get out of this manifold. Okay. Just a small detour if you kind of want to understand this thing in a Lindblad picture. So this is just for people who are kind of familiar with this. You would say you have an evolution of your density matrix, which is described by a so-called Lindblad superoperator. This is this guy. Then you search kind of eigendensity matrix of this guy. These are kind of then you can just write down any density matrix as a superposition of the eigendensity matrices, as you know from the Schrödinger picture. And this eigenvalues here tell you how fast the system decays towards kind of the stationary state. Now, if you have bistability, typically what you have a structure of your Lindblad eigenvalues where you have many eigenvalues. You have a continuum of eigenvalues here, which are separated from the steady state by some parameter of the order of gamma, of the order of the decay. And then you have like two states here. One metastable state, which is like almost at zero, so it has a very, very slow decay rate, and one state which does not decay. And this is exactly kind of the picture for these two states. So you have these kind of two states here, which have a very, very long lifetime, but only one of them lives infinitely long. The other one decays eventually. Okay. So this was just a detour. I will not talk about Lindblads anymore. Okay. So if we look at one dimension, typically, how do we expect a first order phase transition to appear? You know kind of first order phase transitions from kind of boiling water, essentially. So you know when the system undergoes a first order phase transition, it does this via kind of nucleation of droplets and then kind of expanding or growth of the droplets. So in contrast to a second order phase transition where at the transition point, both phases are essentially identical, at the first order phase transition, you can well distinguish the two phases. But what happens is that you have this noise activation here just locally happening, like you form a bubble of steam inside boiling water, and then this bubble wants to either expand or collapse. And when all the bubbles want to expand, then the system goes from one phase into the other. Now the system, now the situation is here a bit different, because if you think about boiling water, inside each kind of steam bubble, you have still thermal fluctuations, the same fluctuations that you have inside the liquid water. But now what we say is that if you form a droplet in this phase, there are no fluctuations. So in principle, you're talking about boiling water where inside your bubbles, there are no thermal fluctuations. There are no fluctuations at all. So all your bubbles are essentially pure states, and only a mixture happens at the boundary and in the liquid phase. And this we see here. So we just plot stroboscopically here the order parameter nu. So this is 1 here. This is 0. The x-axis is spatial coordinate. We are in one dimension. And we have different shots at different times. So what we see is that the system, it oscillates a lot around. But most of the kind of order parameter is around 1. So we initialize the system here. But then suddenly, we see here the formation of a droplet. So there's a finite region in which the field jumps to 0. So this is like a droplet. This is like a steam bubble. And then we see that at the next time, this thing is expanding. And we see there are no fluctuations here. So only fluctuations are where the field has a finite value. And we see the nucleation of more droplets here, and all these guys are expanding. So the system wants to go into the other phase. Here we have a droplet that is forming that actually collapses in the next time step. So there's also kind of some droplets are collapsing. But at the end, the system wants to go into this non-fluctuating phase here. OK. So these are kind of the real space pictures for different noise strength. We just see this is the x-axis, this is time. And again, these dots just represent the formation of these droplets. And again, we see once the thing is blue, this means it's in a non-fluctuating phase, nothing is happening there. And the only way to get back into the fluctuating phase is via the motion of these domain walls. OK, so what happens typically, I mean, now this was more kind of illustrative. So what happens in kind of first order phase transitions or systems that show the first order phase transitions, you have many scales. So what happens, you start kind of in a kind of, if you think in terms of an RG picture, you start integrating out kind of fluctuations. Now you have short wavelength fluctuations, which are smaller than the droplets that want to form. These just renormalize your potential effectively. Now you hit some scale at which kind of droplets are very likely to be formed. So when kind of the system wants to jump from one phase into the other, and there suddenly kind of the whole evolution or the whole RG kind of in your system changes, because then suddenly you really renormalize strongly your potential. But then once you kind of overcome this scale, again, kind of what dominates the dynamics is the formation, is the kind of motion of the domain walls, so the borders between kind of one phase and the other. So you have kind of very different dynamics on very different scales at first order phase transitions, which means kind of a standard RG scheme typically is not able to resolve what happens at a first order phase transition. But since my background is kind of field theory and functional randomization group, we were thinking, what can we do here? And we thought, OK, let's not kind of try a standard scheme. Let's say what we're doing, we choose kind of a Langevin truncation for our RG scheme. We say we want to do RG, but we want to kind of have a system that always has the form of a Langevin equation. So in principle, what is happening, we say we do RG, which renormalizes our potential, which renormalizes our noise kernel, but we always can kind of write this down in terms of an effective Langevin equation. And this is like potential, I mean, this is like numerically, because we have to resolve really the full form of the potential and the full form of the noise kernel. And there are some technical details. But essentially, just we did some benchmarking and comparing this scheme with really the simulations from a Langevin equation in one dimension. And what we get from a thermal kind of simulation is that we get perfect agreement from the FRG. So this is like the yellow line here is the FRG scheme. And this kind of, you don't see it even. The green and blue lines, which are just lying below this, are simulations. And this is the mean field prediction. So in 1D, if we have kind of a thermal system, we have no phase transition. So this is the mean field prediction of first order phase transition. But if we have thermal noise, which means always constant, we have just a crossover. And this is predicted by both numerical simulations and our RG scheme. Now, if we go to kind of multiplicative noise, the problem is that Langevin simulations get very, very complicated, because it's very hard to implement kind of this multiplicative noise. I don't want to go into the details again. If you're interested, we can do that later. But just to show, we choose here different kind of numerical simulation schemes for the Langevin equation. And this is our FRG result. And we see kind of these two guys, they kind of, it takes very, very small time steps in order to converge. This one even takes much longer, but eventually it might also converge to this point. So the FRG is kind of very powerful in this regime where you have this multiplicative noise in terms of computational resources. Okay. Now we're looking at the transitions in different dimensions. So we start with 1D, where for the thermal kind of situation, we just take the same potential, which has a biostability, we take a constant noise level, and we look at the system, we get a crossover. And there are actually in equilibrium kind of phase transitions with a kind of constant noise level in 1D are forbidden. So there is this earlier Landau argument, which kind of tells you what you have in 1D is that the entropy gain by forming domain walls is always kind of beating the kind of energy cost of being well localized in one of the energy minimums of the potential. So in principle, this kind of simple argument tells you that there's no continuous or first order phase transition in one dimension for a real field. And the situation here is, however, different, because we still have this property that if we are kind of, this is again the mean field line here, but if we are in this regime, also our noise dies. So we have no entropy here in this system. There's no entropy gain if we form a domain wall. This means there's kind of no, this argument does not apply. It only applies to one side of the phase transition, but not to the other one. So what we find, this now looks a bit complicated here. What we're looking at here, this is the potential, this is the flow, the RG flow of the potential. So this is our RG scale here, and this is, so there should be spin density here, but it's also rhythmic density is also fine. And this is the kind of this is kind of the RG evolution of the noise potential. And it's very hard to kind of illustrate this because, again, there happens many things on different time scales. But just look at this. So what we're seeing, these are these black lines are kind of the zero lines of the potential. So if we're looking at this, we have a field and we have a potential, and the black lines are kind of these lines here, and the red line is the minimum of the potential. Now, if we look at the RG flow here, we see that we start somewhere where the potential minimum is here at a finite value, but then during the RG, what happens, it flows continuously to zero. And this tells us what we find here is kind of a second order phase transition, because we have a continuous evolution as a function of the RG flow, where the system undergoes kind of wants to find its new minimum in this zero field configuration. And this is kind of if we start below the transition. If we start above the transition, what we're seeing here is essentially the minimum gets renormalized, it gets shifted closer to zero, but it remains at a finite value. So there is kind of no phase transition happening here. If we look at the kind of noise vertex, what happens is initially it's linear in the field. This is what I showed you. So we have this dark state here, but the dark state is just kind of a very small point in phase space, essentially. So you really have to hit it. If we do the RG, what we find, if we are below the transition, so if the system wants to go into the dark state, we find that the noise vertex actually evolves somewhat like this. It tells us there's a finite range where we don't see fluctuations, which kind of gives the system the chance to kind of really go into this dark state without experience any kind of noise activation. This is kind of shown here. I understand it's hard to see. So if we go to larger dimensions, essentially what we find is that there is a phase transition as a function, or that is a change of the nature of the phase transition as a function of the noise strength. So if we start with this multiplicative noise, but very kind of very low noise level, then what happens is we see a first order phase transition. So here we again see kind of these zero lines of the potential plotted, and we see the evolution of the minimum, and then we see kind of this evolution just jumps. So this minimum jumps from here to here, these two lines merge here, there is still kind of a local minimum here, but it's not longer the global minimum. So in this case, we really see a jump of the potential, and we see a first order phase transition. And the nice thing here, if we plot kind of some measure of the flow, of the RG flow, then we really resolve this droplet scale. So this is shown here. This is kind of the convexity of the potential, which means how much gets the potential renormalized. It's also, you can choose any other observable that gives you a measure for the RG flow or the strength of the RG flow, but this is very convenient because one can kind of easily compute it. It tells you we start here. This is our RG scale here, and this is the convexity. And now we start here, and initially we get some renormalization of our potential, but not much changes. But then when we hit this droplet scale, we get kind of another sharp scale where the RG flow again is very much accelerated. So essentially what happens here, the system becomes renormalized, but it doesn't really change its shape. But then this is exactly at this point here, what we're seeing kind of a strong additional renormalization where kind of the droplets are now resolved in this RG scheme. And if we go to the noise vertex flow, we see that kind of this is really important. Because again, if I plot the noise vertex, can you actually see this? Maybe. If you plot the noise vertex as a function of this field, and we have chi here, then it starts linear, but when we hit this additional droplet scale, what happens, we get a B-modal structure of this noise vertex, which tells us it now has very strong fluctuations at this two minima of the potential. So essentially what happens at this scale is that the system is just jumping between one minimum to the other, and fluctuations at these values are strongly pronounced, but in the meantime, in the middle, there's not really much happening. And once you overcome this scale again, then your noise again kind of becomes flat, and you get kind of a very nice dark state here. So we found that this is a very important kind of, very important ingredient in order to resolve first order phase transitions within an RG scheme, because normally what you do, you say your noise level is always fixed and you take it as a temperature. But this tells us on top of the temperature, you have these additional fluctuations that suddenly occur that tell you you have this kind of nucleation dynamics going on where these droplets are forming, but then at the end, this kind of bimodal structure vanishes again, and you go back to your initial or your final kind of noise.
Can I stop here for a second?
Yeah.
So again, with that small graph that you were describing, I just wanted to make sure I understood what you said. So
yeah.
First of all, that graph exists because your noise is multiplied.
This graph always should always exist. It's not depending on which kind of noise you're having.
So why is that inherently?
Oh, not here. This one. This is the noise vertex. This is what I was drawing there.
And the other thing is, what determines that vertical line where the transition is?
Here. So on the mean field level, you would say you have some competition between. So what happens is, if you want to form a droplet, it gets some kinetic, it gets some potential energy because it's kind of, the field goes to a different position.
Mm-hmm.
So you go from here to here, so you have a potential energy difference. But if you are in finite dimensions, then you also have a surface of your droplet, and this costs kinetic energy. And what you want to kind of minimize is this total energy cost, and this tells you essentially the scale at which these guys are formed.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you make them, yeah, right. So this is kind of the typical, people call it droplet scale. You have a mean field estimate for this. It's in some situations very accurate. In other situations, it's kind of far off. But this tells you what's going on here.
Okay, now, given that, can you describe the non-equilibrium one?
The non-equilibrium one, so what you see is, can you see this here? Or?
Yeah.
Maybe can you see kind of, can you see this green line?
Yes.
So this green line gives you this bimodal structure. You start here, your noise vertex is still linear in the field, so it's a linear function.
What is noise vertex? What is that term?
If you look at the Langevin equation and say, what is my noise as a function of my field configuration?
Okay.
This is like the noise. This
vertex is an Feynman vertex.
Yeah, so in essentially it tells you. So if these are your quantum lines in a non-equilibrium field theory, then this guy here. Okay. So it's linear in the field. This is like non-equilibrium.
Uh-huh.
Then it does this when you hit this scale, and you see it really jumps. So this is like a small, okay, it jumps from like almost zero on this plot to some finite value, and you get this B-modal structure here. And this B-modal structure is essentially kind of telling you the system is jumping between these two positions. There is a large fluctuations, while here there are no fluctuations, essentially, if you initialize the system here. And kind of this is our, we say, okay, you need this in order to really resolve what happens at the first order phase transition. Because if you don't take this into account, if you say this is always flat, then it kind of misses the fact that the system jumps between these two points somehow, and fluctuations are pronounced here.
And that is a direct consequence of the multiplicative noise?
That is a direct consequence of our approach, letting the noise vertex flow and treating it as a kind of RG parameter. Then how it starts and how it ends, that's kind of a consequence of our approach.
And that's not something you can get in ordinary RG?
In ordinary RG, typically, this is constrained by symmetry to a constant value. The point is, I mean, you always truncate your system. Sometimes it's useful to, if you do a truncation, to kind of forget about some symmetries, because then you put some of the evolution that should happen here. We tried to do this, and we actually saw that it partially works, but it makes it super complicated. So we just say, OK, here there's no symmetry anyway. In thermal equilibrium, it also works. But we just kind of, it's better to violate the symmetry for a moment and then come back to it later. You get better results, actually. Okay, so kind of we see these phase transitions in this model. And I'm skipping this part, but now I would like to come to the thing that I kind of announced. So this was the background for what comes now, because now we want to kind of see this thing in an experiment. And if we go to experiment, we have to go away from our idealized model, essentially. So we have additional kind of dynamics. We have strong phasing of this upper spin state. So here, if you are in this state, you kind of experience a strong phasing, which means it kills, in your spin language, all kind of spin coherences, essentially. Then you have this off-resonant excitations that I already mentioned, and also you have an additional situation in the experiment, because I was talking only about spin downs and spin ups, but in the experiment actually, spin ups, there are these highly excited atom states, and if you have anything like a remaining electric field or any other effects can cause kind of a ionization of this guy, and then it just escapes your system. So essentially, what you should kind of bear in mind is that in the experimental setup, if you have a spin up, it does not necessarily kind of decay into the spin down again, but it can also just kind of completely escape the system. And this gives you some very interesting additional dynamics. So I'm just showing the Langevin equation for kind of the experimental realistic setup that the people in Strasbourg, that are now in Strasbourg and where when the experiment was done in Heidelberg, describes their system. So you have the same Langevin equation essentially up to here that I was talking about before. And then you add this additional guy here, which is non-Markovian. So essentially what you're having, you have this term here, which is proportional to the field. This is this off-resonant excitation rate, and this kind of couples to the history of the system. So there's some non-Markovian feedback. And this just essentially comes from this loss mechanism. Because what the system does, it kind of remembers how many spins were excited. These excited guys were lost with some rate. And so what develops is some history of how many spins were excited during the whole evolution of the system. OK. Now again, we're coming back to kind of this plot, which I was showing initially. So we're looking now at this Langevin equation here. It's simulated down here, but let's look first again at this plot here. So we initialize the system in a situation where all the spins are pointing down. So this is like a dark state. The system doesn't evolve in time. It doesn't do anything. But then by some off-resonant excitation, one spin gets excited. And because the system now was initialized very close to a critical point, actually this spin can now excite very many other spins in its neighborhood, and it starts an avalanche passing throughout the whole system. And then initially, kind of this avalanche is really large, and these guys are not really correlated, but then this non-Markovian term sets in, and what it does is kind of it is like a growing decay rate, essentially. So if your decay rate initially was very small and this state was favorable, what happens here is now that that proportional to the number of excitations, your decay rate is growing, and actually your kind of mass effectively grows to zero. And then in this regime, where your effective decay rate or your effective mass is almost zero, you see kind of critical dynamics to which the system tunes itself. If you forget about this off-resonant excitation rate, you actually remain forever in this critical state where always avalanches are kind of caused, they're propagating through the system, they're decaying, and then new avalanches are started. So here we do the simulation, and if we again are in 1D, this is space, this is time, and now we look here, there's nothing going on, we are in this dark state essentially, but then here at the boundary actually it happens, there's one spin excited, and it starts an avalanche of many, many excitations. So this is like a large density of excitations. So blue means we're all down, we have no excitations, then the kind of the more it deviates from blue, the more excitations we're having. So we have this first kind of thing here, where all these guys are essentially excited, but there's kind of too many excitations, so we don't see any structure. But as soon as we go forward in time, we see kind of, we enter a regime for a very long time, which is this one, where the system is critical, and it forms these fractal structures of excitations, and you see these kind of avalanches. So this is kind of this non-Markovian regime in here. So if you want to kind of categorize the system, so this behavior that we see here in this regime, this is something that people know as self-organized criticality. What happens is that the system, no matter how you initialize it, tunes itself towards a critical state and stays there for a very long time. And if we look at kind of the signatures of this state, so this is like theory and experimental, we just take kind of the experimental parameters. We have some initial density of spins, we have some final density of spins. We have a detuning and we have a laser intensity. So these are the knobs that the experiment has. And if you're looking at kind of the final density of this thing, then what we find, it's a universal scaling function of these parameters. And so this means we kind of can, as a function of our initial parameters, I mean, we only need this function essentially. We just know we can rescale all the initial parameters in order to kind of let the final density collapse on this line. So this is what we're seeing here. So essentially, this is the experiment at different kind of initial densities. It initializes these, the spin density or a certain spin density. We see here, this is actually time, what we're seeing here. No, this is kind of the intensity. So we see, depending on the initial density, we have a certain critical value here, after which kind of the system ends on this line. And this is the same as here. So rescaling kind of tells you, or we can rescale the whole thing just to sit on this line. Here, the parameters are such that the system is in the absorbing phase. So the initial density is just kind of one, which means it doesn't change. But then suddenly we kind of hit this omega such that we kind of would like to go into this active phase, but because we have this additional driving mechanism which brings us back to the critical point, we always kind of end up on this line. So this means like this is kind of the, as a function of our initial density, this would be the critical line here. And the system, no matter where you put it, it always wants to end up on this line. Okay, so if we look at the dynamics again in this regime, what we find and what's the typical signature for self-organized criticality is a scale invariant distribution of these excitation avalanches. So what I'm looking here at is again the picture, this is again time and space, so I have no labels here, but this is time and space in a one-dimensional system, and now we're looking at these kind of avalanches here, and we wonder how are their kind of lengths distributed. So such an avalanche, either kind of, it starts here and it branches with other guys here, so that's kind of the length of this guy, or it just kind of terminates at some point. So these are the lengths of this thing. If we look at their distribution of these lengths, then we find that they're very well distributed according to a power law. So there's no scale kind of telling you, there's no exponential scale or whatever in there, which cuts them off or which kind of sets a lower bound. Of course, if you work in a lattice, you have some kind of lower UV cutoff. But there's no upper scale, and this works over decades. So this is at the moment just theory. Now the experiment has also some new data, which is just preliminary, and I'm not showing this, but they also find kind of the same distribution of avalanches in your system. What's that question?
Theory computational or theory?
This is simulations at the moment. The problem is just if you ask, so we kind of understand via RG the underlying phase transition, but this additional driving mechanism, these are all relevant directions. So it's very hard because they kind of tell that there are, you know, Cardi tried, for instance, to do this already in the 80s and look at this and try to make this as small as possible. The thing is there's no really kind of good RG solution for this, so no analytical solution what's going on. There are some mean field solutions which predict like this should be 3/2, to which we are kind of close, but there's no kind of, okay. So, and this is very nice because now what we see is that we kind of see this avalanche dynamics, this self-organized criticality, which we kind of well understand in this system, in also a very well-controlled system. Because self-organized criticality in different, I mean, there are several models for this, so this is not the only model, but also this model is realized in kind of many different situations in nature, in many kind of non-equilibrium situations. I mean, here are some examples. Now in neural networks or kind of in brain activity or kind of like biological systems, there's a lot of research activity nowadays where people want to kind of understand why they see kind of the self-organized criticality. So what they're doing is they're taking some mice or some doves, and they kind of trigger some, they give them some kind of light pulses or whatever, so they trigger some reaction in the brain, and then they measure kind of how strong do they feel, do they see a reaction kind of in the brain, or if they kind of put in electrodes and measure how far our information is information kind of propagating in neural kind of systems in biology, they find kind of the same behavior. They find kind of avalanches which are distributed according to this power law, but there is no microscopic model for this. And in most of these examples, because you have like large scale problems where you don't have any control over the parameters, so people can just write down phenomenological models for this, but it's very hard to kind of test, and it's very hard to kind of adjust. And here this is very nice, because now you have kind of a system where you very well understand from the microscopics where your ingredients for the self-organized criticality are coming from, and you can kind of tune them and see what happens if you go away from this. So I'm already at the conclusion. So the first part was kind of telling you more about this dark state phase transition, which is kind of the underlying phase transition for the self-organized criticality. And it's kind of rather important to understand what's going on there. Now, if you kind of add this additional kind of driving and loss that you have in the experiment, you resolve this avalanche dynamics and you see this kind of self-tuning of the system towards a critical point, which is at the moment in the experiment only metastable, but the time scale on which the system remains critical is really, really large compared to all the internal dynamics. So the outlook is, why is this kind of, why I find this so interesting? I mean, there are several things just looking at this phase transition. You can think of, okay, what are the kind of phase ordering kinetics for the phase transition itself? You have a first order phase transition. Typically, you don't think about universality in terms of static parameters, but if you think about the phase ordering, so when, how does the system dynamically go from one phase to the other, that typically shows scaling and aspects of universality. And here you have this kind of non-equilibrium, because the system is out of equilibrium, it wants to go from one phase to the other. This is a long-term process, but you also have this additional non-equilibrium noise. So the question is, can you find kind of different universality classes for the phase order and kinetics compared to thermal equilibrium? The other question is kind of, we wrote down this Langevin equation, so it was a purely classical equation essentially, because we said we're going on larger scales, we have dissipation and the problem, we can neglect quantum fluctuations. But what we find is that when we are in this dark state regime, where the system wants to go into a dark state, here again what I'm plotting is this noise vertex. It's hard to see. Here's the noise vertex, and here's the field, and we see this large region where this noise vertex becomes zero. But if this noise vertex becomes zero, the system is very susceptible. It means there are no statistical fluctuations here, so it becomes very susceptible to quantum fluctuations. So the question is actually, can quantum fluctuations give you a stable dark state or robust dark state, or would they kind of ruin this picture, which is purely classical at the moment? The next thing you already asked is kind of, can we find some SOC universality? People find kind of the same exponents everywhere, but they don't know why. So the same model or different models which kind of have the same underlying phase transition typically give you the same exponents, but you cannot explain the exponents just coming from the phase transition. So there's no idea how these exponents emerge actually. But then there's even more. If you think about this, What you see, for instance, is if you think again about neural networks, what people observe is you see this kind of perfect avalanches. You see like a typically 1/omega noise in these systems in healthy individuals. Now, if people become sick, like they're in a coma or they have some other kind of thing that distorts kind of the neural activity, then typically what you see is like more periodic kind of evolution of your avalanches. So you don't see this 1/omega noise, and you don't see like a scale invariant distribution of avalanches, but you see just some spikes. So you see that there is an avalanche passing through the system, then it takes a very long time. It's almost always the same period until another avalanche passes. And with the theoretical model that we're looking at, you can very well explain what's going on there. And of course, now the experiment can tune these things. In kind of biological systems, you really don't know what's kind of the underlying. You write down a phenomenological model. So this ingredient that gives us this behavior totally is not present in kind of these phenomenological models. So it would be very interesting to kind of see if like systems that display self-organized criticality or deviations from it are actually have some additional parameters that we can also tune in the experiment, such that you can kind of go from this critical to some other phase. And of course, at the end, there is like the question, in terms of the question, like typically you say, or many people assume that kind of biological networks, they have some mechanism which tunes them to some optimal condition. There's the saying, on the edge of chaos, that's where kind of all living is, or all biological systems are kind of located, which is kind of exactly at this point, a phase transition from kind of dark state or from kind of a trivial state towards a very active state. And one believes, or many people believe, that kind of there is some inherent mechanism in kind of biological systems in humans that brings us to some self-organized critical point, because this is in very many senses kind of an optimal condition. So the question is, of course, if you talk about quantum networks, if you talk about quantum systems, is there some notion of self-organized quantum criticality? And this is something I'm working on at the moment, but the main problem here is because quantum mechanics is purely reversible. So it's very hard to kind of have this. I mean, this relies very much on a kind of balance between some driving and dissipation ruins all kind of entanglement or coherence. So it's kind of hard to implement a quantum version of this. And people kind of fail doing this since a long time. So I hope kind of having the experiment gives us some advantage here. Okay, thank you very much for your time. And I would like to thank you, my collaborators, which kind of accumulated over time, because this is like a long-term project. But I hope you liked it, and I'm at the end. Thank you very much.
So it's probably kind of a dumb question, but I'm a bit confused about the return to the dark state.
Yeah.
So in equilibrium first order phase transitions, once you're below, let's say you're between the thermodynamic phase transition but above the super cooling limit,
mm-hmm.
you can, if you wait long enough, you will have an homogeneous state, right? All droplet will have coalesced in an homogeneous symmetry broken state. Then you'll never return to the disordered phase because the energy barrier is infinite.
Yeah.
And so now you were arguing that you can return because you can always have noise in the self, not in the flip state or whatever you call it, the ordered state.
Yeah.
And you can climb over the barriers to the noise and return to dark state where it absorbs the states.
Yeah.
So what's the difference here?
So I'm sorry, this was just a mean field picture. So you can very well, I mean, there is a robust non-dark state phase in this system. So in the mean field picture, you say you don't have spatial fluctuations, so you can overcome this barrier always, and you will always end up in a dark state. But if you have spatial fluctuations, you have these droplets. So you have to form these droplets. They have a finite size in order to kind of be formed, because if they're kind of just one lattice size or very small, the energy difference is just too large. So they're just thermodynamically forbidden. Even the noise cannot activate them, essentially. Now you have to kind of have a certain size of these guys. They still can be activated, but then you have the domain walls. And the domain walls tell you if this thing wants to grow or not. So you can totally stabilize exactly. You have the same phenomenology if you are in kind of the fluctuating phase, as you have in thermal equilibrium. Just the phase transition itself and the dynamics at the phase transition are very different. And our question was exactly this. Can we find, kind of, if we have a bistable, like a bistable potential or like a double well potential, can we find kind of a robust active phase or kind of fluctuating phase? And DRG tells us yes we can, and simulations also tell us yes we can. Just it's not the same kind of at the phase transition or close to the phase transition. It's a very different kind of phenomenology. But what you just described can totally happen.
Two questions. So if I have a closed system,
yeah,
and a pure state,
yeah,
describing transition between two phases, let's say it would be a first order transition,
yeah,
then system has effective temperature despite being a closed system, just locally. So most confusion is that pure state has no, you're saying pure state has no fluctuation, so that's why you are, a lot of your arguments in that statement. That, but if I look at a subsystem of that,
yeah,
it has lot of fluctuations because,
yeah, in this case also the pure state is a very kind of special pure state because it's all spins pointing.
It's just
down.
Product state, that's why it has,
yeah,
no fluctuations. But that was a special feature of this specific model. But is it a fine-tuned statement by changing the model?
It is a statement that you don't have kind of statistical fluctuations and you don't have any kind of fluctuations coming from quantum superpositions of the state. Now, if you have quantum superpositions and you go to a subsystem, of course you get a mixed state kind,
right,
of. The question is, typically what you're having is that quantum fluctuations in kind of this in this field theory enter different than kind of classical fluctuations. They enter typically as something that is non-local in time or something that has higher order in the quantum field, so it gives you a different mechanism. So kind of this is, in a sense, this is like, we wanted to understand, does this happen for a system that has only purely classical but no kind of quantum fluctuations if you coarse grain it, and it happens. Now, just what I said here is kind of, if you now take a state that has quantum fluctuations, and here this was a statement just totally relying on, you don't have any classical fluctuations in your kind of total system, but quantum fluctuations could kind of destroy this or not. So we don't know. So the first layer of kind of understanding is.
Can I ask you another question?
I guess.
About the phase transition. So if I have a first order transition, there's no divergent correlation. Then, so generally you expect that there are no interesting power law,
yeah,
scaling. So,
yeah.
But here you are saying, even if it were a first order transition, even then you have various power laws. I'm just confused about.
So typically, if you have a first order phase transition, you don't have kind of power laws in your kind of static observables, essentially, because,
right,
you have to jump. But if you wonder, let's say you just go across this first order transition, and then you wonder how the total system kind of goes from one phase to the other,
then they are.
Typically, there you find scaling behavior. I'm not sure if this is something universal. So people have found this, and kind of because it's dynamic.
Talking about coarsening, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, we have some power laws, but they are generally understood in a fairly, I mean, they are constrained by the symmetries. There's,
right,
there's not much, I mean, for example, different model ABC have different universal power laws. But
exactly,
like fractal-like structure is like more different,
yeah,
than.
There's no kind of the notion of universality classes is not,
right,
that kind of established as for second order phase transitions. But we're just wondering in general, can we kind of find something like this? How strong are these typical findings modified if we have this non-equilibrium noise in the system?
So what about in SOC empirically? Have people found different universality for these?
So people have found different scaling exponents. Oh. And in non-equilibrium phase transitions, often you don't have any symmetry. And the only thing you say, okay, we have universality classes because we find kind of exponents that are in a sense universal because you have many kind of microscopic models which give you the same exponents. So essentially what you're taking, you take all the exponents that you can find, say this is one universality class. There are some which have kind of symmetries. But for SOC, there are also where how people kind of sort it.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Just empirically, just going to the literature and tabulating what,
yeah,
you've been known.
Yeah.
Is there a continuous spectrum of number, or is it like...
Well, it's very hard to tell. I would say, I mean, There are some classes, but they have fine structures, let's say. And depending on what you're doing, so there are mean field classes, let's say, where you say, okay, mean field predicts me this exponent, like for the one we're looking at, it's 3/2. But if you do the simulation, we find something different. People have tried some kind of different kind of rate models for the same thing, where they say, okay, let's write this down in terms of rate equations, let's do the simulations, they find mean field exponents. Other people have used another approach, they find kind of for the same kind of microscopic origin, they find different exponents, and it's not clear if it's an error of the numerics or if it matters that you're kind of away from kind of the ideal model. So I don't know. So there is typically what you have numbers like 2, 1.5, 1, and typically it stays close to that if you want to do the exact thing. But there are fine structures, depending on who solves it and how.
In your model, can you have the equivalent of a tricritical point or a critical point?
It has. And it actually, it's a function of the noise strength. So there's also this very interesting, so what you do is, in 1D, it's always a first order phase transition. If you forget about the self-organized criticality thing and just go to the underlying model, in 1D, it's always second order. There is now a lot of research going on. What is the universality class? Because we predict something from the RG. I did simulations on this in 1D also for the kind of Pre-Langevin equation. I get something different, and there are people who are doing matrix product states who also get something very different. So it's not clear. So the only thing that we all find is in 1D, it's always a second order phase.
Well, I guess I was asking if you can take a situation where it's first order and by changing
Exactly. Now if I go to 2D or 3D and I change the noise level, so that's the only thing I do this artificially, because the noise level typically is kind of related to the decay via non-equilibrium fluctuation dissipation relations, but I can just play around with it and say I make this larger or smaller and I find a tricritical point. So I see a first order phase transition that becomes second order and I have this point, and we try to also analyze this, but kind of again there's
But that's not changing the bare parameter in the potential, though, right? It's two.
Exactly, it's the same potential. So you just did the picture. I mean, this is something that also people from biological systems know. They say you have an underlying potential, you have some fluctuations on top of this, and these fluctuations can make you kind of going from a first order to a second order phase transition, because essentially you can imagine if your fluctuation level is much smaller than your potential well, essentially, then you really resolve the double well. When you crank it up, then at some point the system kind of can just easily jump between the two minima, but it still resolves where the total minimum is. And now if you change it, you get essentially
like the same model in two dimensions.
Yeah. That in 2 and 3 dimensions you see that. In 1 dimension is always second order.
You know anything between coma and healthy brain? Like schizophrenic or bipolar?
It's just an example. So.
No, but seriously, I mean, do you see like different...
There are, for all these things, there are different kind of things. The typical thing is either you see like something that is periodic or quasi-periodic, or you see something that is kind of supercritical, that just has constant activity and is so noisy that you cannot resolve any signal anymore. And that's kind of also why people kind of think self-organized criticality is a mechanism to kind of establish optimal networks, because you're saying like what you would like to have periodic signal is, of course, you can perfectly resolve your signal. But the problem is kind of it only, you have to fire kind of information with a rate that is determined by this periodicity. On the other hand, if you kind of say, okay, let's fire constantly, then you cannot resolve the signal anymore. So it has to be somewhere in between. And that's kind of where it works optimally.
The fact that, you know, you have a whole spectrum of different brain wave activities,
brain
alpha, beta, all the way to
absolutely
bigger waves, right?
Yeah.
And so this is a overly simplistic.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's just kind of what I'm saying is that this model for self-organized criticality that we get kind of just starting from the microscopics, it has additional ingredients that these models never consider. When they never consider these, they can only resolve kind of the optimal state, but they never see how they kind of changing another variable, they get to this kind of behavior. I mean, if I was done with this, then I would be very happy, I guess I would be famous, but.
Money.
Right, let's thank you again.